This is the EWN Radio Network.
She's smart. She's successful. She's an executive. She's an entrepreneur. And she's the chief executive of her story. Who is she? She's you. Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network. Your Power Lunch Hour, keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome back to the Power Lunch, sponsored by Enterprise Capital, your business partner for commercial financing. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, with my lovely and handsome co-host, Jay Como.
Good to be back.
Well, we've had some changes to our content. We apologize. We've not been with our listeners for the last few weeks as we've taken care of some coming changes that we'll be doing. So we'll share that with you in future segments. But today, and specifically March, it's been a great month because there's a couple of great things that are happening in March. Last week specifically, on March 8th, was International Women's Day. It's a global day celebrating the economic, political, and social achievements of women past and present and future. Now, to be fair, we probably haven't heard a lot about it in the past. It's not celebrated in the United States as much as it is in other countries outside of the U.S., specifically the U.K. and Australia. And it's known more abroad, but the United States is doing a better job in actually giving more visibility to International Women's Day. So if you were following it on Twitter, you probably saw a lot of hashtags referencing International Women's Day. Hashtag make it happen, hashtag IWD2015. A number of celebrities domestically did tweet out on behalf of International Women's Day. Our founder, Sandra Yancey, did, along with Condoleezza Rice and Oprah. And two tweets that I thought were particularly interesting was Desmond Tutu, the famous social South African activist and retired Anglican bishop from South Africa. He tweeted a personal video, which he made specifically for International Women's Day, and it was titled, it was very short, it was I Believe in Women and Girls Leadership. And it talked about how customs within the cultures have to change for the equalization of women, that there's a huge benefit to focus first on how the social norms are viewed in countries. And I think, Jay, we talked about this past week with some of the atrocious news that we've heard that's come out of recently out of India as they continue to struggle with some of sexual violence on women.
Yeah, I think equalization of women has to pick up steam in Africa as a continent. Human rights needs to take a huge step forward there as well. But India's got a problem. They're culturally, what's going on with young women there and old women and all women really is frightening. And you know, you and I have both been there many times, and it's a place that we've expressed an interest in the past to spend more time, but it's a little scary right now, and they need to get their house in order. There's just a lack of respect for women over there.
Right, especially the social norms in terms of how they treat sexual violence. Christine Lagarde, also, you know, one of the most powerful women in the world, she's the head of the International Monetary Fund, she did a different type of a video clip in support of International Women's Day, talking about the contribution to the economy and how women being employed as entrepreneurs and leaders of companies also help with the equalization of women. So we encourage you to get out there, and if you want to do any research on it or also tweet it out on your own, either hashtag make it happen for International Women's Day, even though it's past, still celebrated throughout the month of March. But you can also follow up with Women's History Month, which is also here in the United States. That's big. That's the entire month of March. And it focuses on the contributions of women to events in history and contemporary society. So you'll probably see a lot of hashtags in regards to hashtag Women's History Month, pretty long. But there are some folks that have done some great features on it. The NPR, G and I know we were talking about this yesterday. We were very surprised that they were founded by three women, Nina Totenberg, Linda Wertheimer, and Cokie Roberts. And so there's an article on that. Makers is also doing something great there.
First of all, I think most of our listeners and people just across the nation, I don't know that they get enough exposure to NPR. For those that do, knowing that it was started by Nina, Linda, and Cokie Roberts, that's a little unknown fact. So kind of cool to see the genesis of how that started.
Yeah, and to also bring visibility to it. So again, hashtag out Women's History Month. We'd love to see what you guys are tweeting out there. Include us on your tweet so we can retweet it and repost it on our Facebook and social media. So let's get into women who made the headlines this past week. Serena Williams, the most winningest female athlete of all time, with $66 million in prize money. She's also ranked number one in tennis, and Forbes ranked her number 69 in the top 100 celebrity earnings. Well, she made headlines this past week for a historic and also personal win at the Indian Wells Tournament, also known as the BNP Paribas Open. Serena and Venus vowed never to participate in the BNP Paribas Open. Well, in 2001, it was marked with steep controversy, and it's actually a very ugly mark on sports history, especially for the sport of tennis, when a then 19-year-old Serena Williams and her sister Venus, along with their father, were booed and jeered for hours at the tournament. They were also ridiculed by opponents whom they beat. Well, at the time, if you remember, the Venus sisters were breaking out into the world of tennis. And it was particularly interesting for all because a couple of things. Number one, they were black, and tennis at the time was still seen as a very elitist sport and only done in country clubs. The second thing is their tennis training didn't happen in, as I stated, country clubs. They were trained by their father in Compton, California, which back in the late 90s, it was a city known more for its gang violence. The Crips and the Bloods, right? That was the Compton that we knew back then. And to make matters worse, for the folks that were frowning upon the new entry of Serena and Venus, is now there were two of them. There were two great tennis stars that were really bucking the trend and then dominating the rankings at a time where black women were not at all seen on the tennis court, nonetheless, two of them and sisters from Compton. Well, in 2001 at the Indian Wells Tournament, and as I stated, Serena and Venus were humiliated on live ESPN in front of millions of viewers as the audience jeered and booed at the young ladies. And watching this and recapping it, it was heart-wrenching. You could see the face of Serena just cringing, and I couldn't even imagine standing in that stadium being booed and yelled at and having racial slurs being yelled at me. Well, Serena's never gone back, and I don't blame her, and neither has Venus, and she has stated in interviews time and time again that she would never go back. Well, this was the first year, and the owner, who's actually Larry Ellison, owns the BNP Paribas Open. Him and his team did a phenomenal job over the last few years trying to court back the Venus sisters to show that the tournament itself has evolved. Serena finally took the invitation, and she said in CNN this past week, quote, "It's been difficult for me to forget spending hours crying in the locker room after winning in 2001, driving back to LA, feeling as if I lost the biggest game of my life. Not a mere tennis game, but a bigger game of equality. The undercurrent in tennis of racism was painful, confusing, and unfair in a game I loved with all my heart at home of my most cherished tournaments. I suddenly felt unwelcome, alone, and afraid." What was touching about that was just you hear the emotion in Serena. You see her as a very powerful woman, again, ranked number one in tennis. But still, that one moment in life has always been kind of the monkey on her back. Well, Friday, she killed it. She overcame those fears, and she beat Monica Niculescu in the final two matches, winning 7-5, 7-5 for the overall prize. And when interviewed, Serena said it wasn't the prize money that was important. It was righting a wrong and showing everyone that she had overcome and forgave a sport and a community that was so unwelcoming to her and her family 14 years earlier. So I encourage you to pull it up. It's a very inspirational moment for Serena, especially for women and for minorities in tennis and for sports as well.
So I think it speaks volumes. One, it speaks volumes of how bad things were not that long ago from a race and gender relations perspective. And in the U.S., not just from sports, but just socially, right? That was a decade and a half ago.
I can't even believe it was the 2000s. It's
right, to think, right, that wasn't that long ago. So to think
it wasn't
for that to happen today would be atrocious and unbelievable. And so that tells you, trying to put a positive spin on it, because that was bad. The good news is, look how far we've come in just a decade and a half from then, because I don't think that would be tolerable in today's society.
Oh,
so that's fantastic.
No.
But I do think pioneers like Tiger Woods and like Serena and Venus being so dominant at their sport has actually helped change culture of America. I mean, she's won multiple Australian Opens, a couple French Opens, won multiple Wimbledons, a bunch of U.S. Opens. And as you said, she's $66 million in earnings. And I think that's without endorsements. That's just prize money.
Right.
And so I think what happens is a decade and a half ago, bad people that don't have open minds go, "We don't like this. This has changed. What's she doing here? She doesn't belong here. We don't like her color."
Right.
And then she
becomes
dominant like Tiger did in golf. And it gets people to, like Jackie Robinson did in baseball. And it gets people to kind of go, "Wait, maybe I should rethink this." And it starts to change the norm. And so she's very much a pioneer. And I don't want to spend too much time congratulating society in America, how far we've come in a decade and a half, how far we've come in 50 years. But it is nice to know that I don't think it could happen again today. And that's a nice evolution for us from a societal perspective. And she gets a lot of credit for it.
I mean, when we talk about trailblazers, Serena, in the area of sports, but just to your point, she's a trailblazer. She stuck to it. She didn't fall out of tennis. This didn't destroy her. It made her stronger. And what was even to your point about we shouldn't celebrate that the community has come farther, I think what can be congratulated is that the tennis tournament owners now say, where they wouldn't allow people to boo and jeer, you know, because it's not formal etiquette. This time they said if they heard anything in that sense of racial commentary and jeering that was just unnecessary, they were going to remove them from the tournament. So I think it's welcoming to hear that even the tournament owners take some accountability. These are not the type of fans that, one, they want to represent their tournament, nor do they want showcasing and being a part of supporting the game of tennis. So that's great. Jay, you've got another one for us. They made headlines this past week.
So the Princeton's women's basketball team defeated Penn recently to close out the regular season 55-42, winning the Ivy League women's basketball championship. They finished the season 30-0. Well, they've now got their bracket slotted. They're the number one team going in, but they didn't lose a game, and them and Kentucky on the men's basketball side are the only two teams in all of college basketball to go undefeated. Their coach has been amazing, Courtney Bangert, and they've been to the tournaments. They've won actually the Ivy League championship 5 out of the last 6 years, but this year they did it in an undefeated fashion, and it's an amazing feat. I mean, it's so easy to lose at basketball. They got 30 games. It's not like, you know, college football or men's football where you play 16 games or 12 games. We're talking 30 times lacing it up and not taking a loss, which is a great accomplishment. So congrats to them for the Ivy League championship, going undefeated, setting the record there, making history, and then good luck to them in the tournament.
When we talk about March Madness, we normally think about men's college basketball. So it's great to see that the Princeton women's basketball team, also heading into the March Madness tournament, are getting the headlines. So I think it's also a great thing to see that the women's basketball teams are starting to get notoriety also within the media as well. So again, good luck to the Princeton ladies team.
So our next is Ronda Rousey. So Ronda is the undefeated UFC bantamweight champion. So this is the mixed martial arts, boxing, wrestling, all combined into one. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, we're not really big UFC fans in our household. However, interesting story that broke, and we wanted to cover it. So Joe Rogan, who's an actor and comedian and also commentator for UFC, commented on a recent match for Rousey where he said she could probably beat 50% of the men in UFC. And so talk about equality, right? The challenge for her is they really are struggling to find a suitable opponent. She took down previously undefeated Kat Zingano in 14 seconds a few weeks ago. There's a gal who fights in a different league, Christy Cyborg, who competes actually at a heavier weight. I believe she competes at 154, and Ronda competes at 135. And so there's talk about Cyborg coming down to a weight for them to both fight at, maybe 135, 140, and that would be the match of the year, but really a match of the sport if it happens, and I think it's getting closer. But back to Ronda. So this commentary about her being able to fight men, she's actually gone on record in the last couple days saying, look, do I think that I could beat 100% of the men out there? And the answer is yes, because until we fight, who knows? And then she said,
she's a badass.
She's definitely making some noise. She did come out, which I think is kind of cool. She came out and, again, said, could I take some men? Did she actually stand up to Cowboy Cerrone, even though it was tongue-in-cheek, but she was dead serious about taking them on? Yes. But she's also said that, I just don't see it happening. While it might be good for sport, and while I'm not afraid to do it, it really isn't the message that we want to send. A man and a woman fighting, a man beating on a woman, whether she wins the fight or not. It's not the message in society that she wants to endorse, even though it's for sport, and even though she could probably take half of the men or three quarters of the men out on this planet, maybe more than that. But I think it shows good integrity that she doesn't want to be a part of a conversation where it's okay to hit women. So she made some press for that. And then lastly, before you comment on her, there is talk that of her perhaps fighting Layla Ali, Muhammad Ali's daughter, who is retired from boxing. She's 37 now, but she went 24-0 and did really wonders for the sport of women's boxing, but she's a bit of a badass herself. Randy Couture, who was in Expendables, all that series, and he's a retired UFC fighter, and he's trained folks in that arena as well. He's actually volunteered to coach Ali to fight Ronda. So everyone wants to seemingly fight Ronda, and she's making some good press, not just because she's amazing at what she does. She's brave, but she's also sending a good social message. That's a pretty cool story out there.
I like it because, you know, when we talk about women trailblazers, in the beginning of our content, we used to be focused predominantly on women in business and women in politics. But in fairness, you have to also give credence to the women in, you know, science or the women in technology, but especially the women in sports, because sports is a universal language. And to see a new sport like UFC that's fairly new in comparison to the other sports, and to see Ronda jump in along with the other female fighters and just take that on and be respected and have that much following, I think is phenomenal. Plus, just watching her interview, she's pretty intimidating. So, you know, I would vote for her to be on my team if I had to go into battle, that's for sure. All right, when we get back, we're going to talk a lot more about women in politics along with women in business. More when we return.
I'm looking for a certain kind of woman, and I think you know her. She's an entrepreneur that is highly connected, successful, significant in her own industry, and considered the go-to woman in her community. She's received so much from so many women in business, she's ready to give back to others on their journey, lifting as she climbs. Hi, this is Sandra Yancey, and I'm the founder and CEO of eWomen Network. I'm looking to connect with the woman I've just described who lives in your community so that we might have a conversation about how eWomen Network's proven success system can provide her a platform to elevate her success and ability to support women in business. Our international community of managing directors are influencing the speed of success for women in business around the world. If that sounds like something that you want to be part of or know someone we should talk with, send an email to managingdirector@ewomennetwork.com. That's managingdirector@ewomennetwork.com, and let's start the conversation.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at Inter Pares Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does. Whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital, we can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At Inter Pares Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network. Your Power Lunch Hour, keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome back to Power Lunch, sponsored by Inter Pares Capital, your business partner for all your commercial financing needs. Whether you need bridge financing or project funding, contact Inter Pares Capital to help you finance your commercial real estate project. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, joined in studio with my co-host, Jay Como. It is Women's History Month, everyone, so make sure to tweet about hashtag Women's History Month or make it happen for your support for women trailblazers and those who continue to pave the way for future generations. When we left, we discussed women in sports, and this segment is Women Headliners Are in Business. So we're going to start off with NABO. If you don't know who they are the largest association for women in networking. The National Association of Women's Business Owners, also known as NABO, turned 40 years old this month. BizWomen.com did a feature article this past week on the first women's networking organization and advocacy group for women in business. It is now a national organization with more than 5,000 members and 60 chapters across the country, a place to turn for resources, mentors, and advice. And its past leaders and founding members paved the way for today's businesswoman, like myself, to have more equal opportunities. And we're pretty supportive and very fortunate to have also interviewed past NABO presidents, such as Whitney Johns-Martin, who is now co-founder of Texas Women Venture Capital, who was also a pioneer for women investors when she led NABO. and spent time with past presidents and White House administrations to further invest in women entrepreneurs.
Yeah, she's obviously very impressive, and being appointed by, was it one or two presidents in the past for work?
She did the first investment committee. I mean, she basically was on the Hill with Alan Greenspan, also part of the group to figure out how to invest in more in women entrepreneurs.
She's just someone who, when you have an opportunity to talk business with, it's really cool. She's down to earth, but knows her stuff, and obviously very decorated from a business perspective, and pretty good golfer from what I hear as well.
Congratulations to NABO. They're doing a lot of events as well as focus on their conference. If you want more information on them, go to nawbo.org. Next for headliners this past week, former Cinnabon president Kat Cole. You've heard us talk about her. She actually makes the Forbes list and the Fortunes list of the most influential. She's under 40, which also she makes influential 40 under 40 list. Well, she made the Upstart and Bizwoman articles this past week, particularly for a couple of reasons. Number one, Kat Cole has been promoted. She used to be the Cinnabon president, and she has been recently been promoted to a larger global role as the president of the Focus Brands. And she's only 36, folks. One of the reasons why she made the headlines is when interviewing her, Kat actually responds to every tweet from her 16,000 followers. And in the Upstart article, she says, quote, "I take it very seriously. It's a way for me to love the people who take even a second to show the love for us." Well, on the border of Gen X and Gen Yers, 36-year-old Cole says she's always had an affinity for Twitter, for the network it creates, for the instantaneous feedback you can get. So she estimates there are probably only 10 or so tweets that she's missed and she didn't reply to since she joined Twitter years ago. We're going to continue to hear more about Kat Cole as she could take the brand to the next level. Very impressive being 36 and being promoted now to group president. Well, talking about other women headliners, Spanx CEO Jan Singer is shaking up Spanx with her rebranding. So she's also new on the list of women headliners that we've talked about. She was featured this past week in Upstart Business Journal and Entrepreneurs. And Jan Szarkanski Singer, she was named Chief Executive Officer of Spanx last July, and she says the company is going through a rebranding to emphasize that it isn't just about selling shapewear for special occasions, but it is also a place for everyday lighter, more comfortable wear, including undergarments and apparel such as jeans and swimsuits.
It'll be interesting to see if they can go to the next level. But I don't know, is there a next level? Like, where do you go?
So they're looking for everyday comfortable wear. So it includes undergarments and apparel such as jeans and swimsuits and sportswear. So swimsuits, I think, is a natural progression because you're still worried about shapewear and everyone would like to look great in swimsuits. I think jeans is for women. We've seen a lot more shapewear kind of been included on the inside of jeans, and that's kind of gained traction over the last several years. But to have the name brand recognition like they do today. So when you say Spanx and somebody else is offering, like Hanes might have shapewear, it doesn't have the branding, the elite branding that you would think of when you think of Spanx. Now, to say that I own Spanx jeans, I don't think will sound as great as saying I have Lucky jeans, right, which are really known. So it'll be interesting how they want to compete in that and if it's their intention to just have a carve out a special place in the market, or do they want to be a known name brand in that sector?
So you're a big fan of their product offering. And
I'm a woman with curves.
So
yes.
Very nice curves, but they did a billion in revenue. Or I'm sorry, the company is valued at a billion. I know they did at least $250 million in revenue. I think they've done a great job from a niche perspective, but you're right. I mean, your view on jeans, like, can they get bigger, or is this kind of their sweet spot?
I think this is their sweet spot, and I think they can get bigger if they expanded into shapewear for working out. I do think that there's a place there. I think that tends to be pretty trendy right now with Lululemon kind of leading up the helm. They're not doing as great anymore because everybody has kind of entered into that space. So it's been interesting to see that everyone's coming out with their own workout attire and kind of pushing it to the next level. So I think that Spanx having that brand recognition on shapewear, it's an easier transition to say that they can get into sportswear and to swim. I think it's a bigger hurdle and less opportunity for them to make a big splash into normal apparel. I mean, if you want to say Spanx sweats, I think that's, you know, almost a contradiction because you can't have sweats and Spanx. But if they wanted to say we are your new Spanx shoes, I specifically being a super shopper, it wouldn't appeal to me. That brand wouldn't appeal to me. So it'll be interesting to see. And to your point, maybe they make their way out into menswear, but if that's the case, I would change the name. I would come up with a new brand. I wouldn't call it Spanx for Men. I would definitely call it something different.
Might be some interesting connotations there.
All right, well, I think you
want to talk about Apple now? Want to segue quickly
out of
that?
Yeah, we'll talk about Apple. Yeah, so real quick before we move on. So Apple, of course, making all the news as Angela Arendt, I can never say her name correctly. She's the Senior Vice President on the Retail Division, and she's also the former executive of Burberry. Well, she was brought on a year or so ago, and there was a lot of talk that the primary reason for bringing her over outside of her executive prowess was that she could add that kind of luxurious appeal. So we'll see what it is in terms of how Apple Watch is going to do and if the experiment with bringing Angela and kind of her expertise to adding. I don't know if I could ever see an Apple Watch as something as appealing as a Versace watch, for instance, or a Rolex. I just don't think that that's ever going to break, but I could be wrong. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm with you in terms of the early view. And we've seen the prototype that came out. We bought our son one. And so
the Samsung
first,
one.
Yeah. It's, I guess, not the prototype of Apple, but the concept, right? So the first blush, from a fashion perspective, I don't think it's going to work for people like you and I, the consumers that will spend a lot of money on watches. However, I would say this. Many years ago, and not that many, but Apple came out with the Touch and, you know, the device where you could put your music on it, and it was really...
The iPods.
Yeah, you know, the iPods, right? And then it came out with the pad, right? The tablet that is now all over the place, but effectively they invented it. They came out with the iPhone, which took smartphones to a whole different direction. Music overall, the way that music is consumed and deployed and produced because of their iPods, they've changed consumerism. They've created markets, not niche markets either, huge markets. So now a lot of that, if not all of it, was done under Jobs' watch from a creative perspective. And anyone who's followed that company knows he was a complete control freak, had his arms around every major product launch, particularly around quality and aesthetics, and his influence was all over the place and apparent. He took them from the brink of destruction and turned them around. So the question is this the next big thing for Apple, and is she going to take it to the next level? I think it'll be interesting. Their commercial played this weekend, and again, a little bit of challenge on the fashion front, but it looks amazing, the watch itself. So she's got a really cool time to go and do this, and if they can fix the fashion piece, I don't know. The timepiece might be the way to go. It's going to be really fun to watch.
You're right. And the whole notion of what happens with wearable technology, I think the reason why I'm a little bit less gung-ho on whether the Apple Watch will work, and maybe it's just timing, is, you know,
no pun intended,
backtrack a couple of years ago when Google Glass came out, right? That was all the rage, and then Google shut that down this year. And so I don't know if society or if we've perfected the wearables yet. And I still think of having a watch that can actually act as your phone and also your other devices. I think that there's a market for people who want to consolidate all the way to that point. Definitely it's taken over from a music perspective, but I still think that it might be a little bit longer play before people are going to completely give up just regular watches. And I would say that the same thing has happened with the tablets versus the computers. I do think that there's been a decline in laptops, but I don't know, after years of using laptops, there's something about using a laptop that a tablet still cannot give you. And you miss a lot of the functionality and also the power that a laptop gives. There's definitely a consumer base. I just don't think that the Apple Watch industry for wearables will be as big as the cell phone industry.
It's a good point, right? I mean, look at us. I have an app for my employer where I can get emails on my phone, a BlackBerry that works better when traveling internationally, a laptop where I can pick up my emails if I'm networked in. And it used to just be a laptop. And, well, frankly, not too long ago, you couldn't even get remote access, right? But it used to be a hard laptop with remote access, and then it turned into BlackBerries, and then it turned into applications like Good for Business. And users like me, it kind of use some faction of all of them. So you're right, it could just be all of the other things, and you still have the Apple. It's an add-on.
But
the question is, I think to your point, it might be an add-on, but are you going to wear it? Because I might not wear that over my Movado.
We'll transition into a break. When we return, one of our biggest headliners are women in politics, and the most talked about women this past week, Hillary and Emailgate. That's right, we called it first, Emailgate. And another fresh face for giving women an alternative vote, Carly Fiorino, and her new Unlocking Potential project. More when we return.
Are you an entrepreneur, coach, or consultant who is tired of constantly searching for the next client? Are you ready to get your expertise out of your head, into the world, and packaged into a profitable online course that delivers a steady stream of your perfect ideal clients to your door and a steady, predictable source of revenue? Hi, this is Janine Blackwell, creator of Create Six-Figure Courses Virtual Bootcamp, and I've created my own seven-figure courses, and I've walked hundreds of experts like you through the step-by-step of creating and launching a profitable online course. I'd like to invite you to a free online training I'm hosting for you called The 7 Steps to Creating and Launching Your Profitable Online Course. I'm going to show you exactly how to create your course, market your course, and automate delivery of it so you can get your course up and running fast and have it work for you 24/7. You can grab your spot for this free training at www.createmyonlinecourse.com. So join me at www.createmyonlinecourse.com.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at Inter Pares Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does. Whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital, we can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At Inter Pares Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network. Your Power Lunch Hour, keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome back to our second half of the Power Lunch, sponsored by Inter Pares Capital, your partner for startups and entrepreneurs growing their business. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, joined by my handsome co-host, Jay Como.
So let's talk about an email gate, as we're calling it. This is a long,
this is
really
the hottest story.
It's the hottest story, but unfortunately, it's the same story if you follow the IRS scandal. In fact, it's the same story that just gets worse. For those of you that aren't too entrenched in, I'll just recap it, and then we can go from there. But effectively, Hillary Clinton decided to use kind of the antithesis of what we just discussed of having in the last segment, having multiple multiple devices. Right?
Ironic.
She decided that's just too kludgy. You know, for someone who traveled 2 million miles around the globe, she wanted one device and one email. That email happened to be a personal email. Now, this is for her Secretary of State role. So State Department business on her personal email, on a server in their apartment in New York. And anyone who deals with any tech infrastructure or works in any major corporation that deals with protecting data, and I'm talking about corporate data, not necessarily data that could hurt the national security of our nation, would really cringe at this. But now we're talking about data. I mean, emails to the president went back and forth to her personal email. The legislation was meant, the regulatory oversight was meant for emails for state business, was meant to be archived instantaneously. Now, the fact that she's on her server that she controls, this didn't happen. And the justification erroneously was, well, when I sent emails to the recipients for Department of State business, it was getting auto-archived on the recipient end. This is not the case now. I think they're changing that. But effectively, Hillary Clinton, when she left office as Secretary of State, turned over about 55,000 to 60,000 pages of emails. Now, these emails were turned over by her, and they were furnished at her demand. So we don't know if it was all of the emails. Committees have kind of gone after her in the House, Trey Gowdy's committee, and also the Select Committee, where Susan Brooks is representative. They've gone out and said, hey, we need your emails. And so 300 emails have been turned over since then. Now the committees are both saying, this doesn't work. You are only turning us over what you know. And as Hillary Clinton mentioned in a press conference, that it's, you know, she's done her best job. She didn't want to turn over personal stuff. You've got the request out there to take the server and bring it to a third-party, non-biased arbitrator where they could go and take a look and do a deep dive on the messaging. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. It's a bad story. You have some additional facts to share as well, but it's frightening for a lot of reasons. Particularly, you've got two things, and I'll hand it over to you. You've got data from the State Department. You've got emails. The secretary does say that she didn't send any emails with respect to national security. However, she did say she predominantly used this email account, so that kind of conflicts. But you've got that out there on just an encryption in the Clinton's apartment, not in the infrastructure of the government. And then you've got, well, I'll turn it over, but I'm going to decide on what I turn over, and you're not getting my server. So that's like pulling someone over for DUI, expecting them of it, saying, hey, do you want to give me a blood sample, a urine sample, so I can test your blood alcohol content level? And then the person getting pulled over says, no, I don't really want to. I'll do it later. I'll do it in like a month. I'll give you a blood sample in a month. I mean, that's pretty much the moral equivalent to this. It's not much different than the IRS, but worse from my view. So are your thoughts on this? And I know you have some additional points there as well.
Well, I think there's a couple things, and let me caveat this for our listeners. You hear me talking about we need to get a woman president and we need to get women in politics. But I'm also a huge advocate of getting the right woman. I believe it's sexist just to vote for somebody just because of their gender or for their race. What I'd rather see is more qualified candidates. And I'm a firm believer that when you have a multi-party system where women are fairly represented on both parties, not just the Democratic Party, but the Republican Party, the Libertarians, and the Greenpeace Party, the likelihood of picking the right candidate to represent all values is better. So that, let me caveat that first by saying that. Secondly, I personally don't think Hillary is the right woman to be elected into president, and it's a pretty strong statement. And if you would have asked me, and my husband can back this up, if you would have asked me this, maybe voted for her in the primaries against President Barack Obama, I thought she was a better candidate then. Since then, I think, number one, I think we need a fresher face and somebody with new ideas and new values. And secondly, I think that there's been some damage done to her credibility when she was Secretary of State, not just because of the Benghazi, but, you know, the reset with Russia, and then also the email standards that she now fast-forwarding into the email standards, because Mrs. Clinton was the person who was very clear with the State Department and sent out an email, ironically, to everyone that no one used personal emails. Now, why? When I heard about the story, I thought, oh, they must be digging. There's no way they're really. Maybe it was a few emails that she had put. So I first thought this story was just a bunch of hogwash and that we were just making, you know, the media was making a huge hullabaloo about nothing. When I understood the story that all of her emails were conducted and official emails were conducted over private emails, well, as you had stated, Jay, earlier, you and I have worked in corporate America. You couldn't even do that in corporate, on the corporate private sector side. And when you were working in a blue ribbon panel, you were very clearly indicated that you couldn't use your personal email. So there's hypocrisy in this, because I can't swallow this for the mere fact that I've been working in the private sector for 20 years, and since we've been using email at least in the last decade, there's been some very distinct clarity made by both private sector companies as well as anybody in government that you must segregate the use of your emails. Number one, they belong to the entity of which you represent. So her personal email address, HillaryClinton@gmail.com, cannot be used for conducting business, because unfortunately all of it can be subpoenaed. And I think, Jay, you were told that for the Blue Ribbon panel, that to protect your own personal email, right, that you should segregate so that they could not be subpoenaed.
And that was for an appointed Blue Ribbon panel for a small town in Texas of 9,000 residents. And we were told that, but the level of sophistication in that panel and the government staff that we worked with is hopefully much different than the Secretary of State. And we were told straight away, you're going to be careful what you send, because it could be subpoenaed and it's all public information and should be. And meanwhile, you've got the secretary saying, well, I didn't want to send stuff, emails regarding Chelsea's wedding or yoga. That's the reason you don't use personal email for state business, is because you don't want those two to get conflicted. However, the difference is
state or corporate. Right? State
right,
or corporate. So
yeah.
there has to be state, consistency in that.
So I guess we'd have to, I don't know if they can, the select committee or Trey Gowdy's committee can actually subpoena. I mean, they're suggesting taking the server. But right now, Hillary's camp says, we're not doing it. We've turned over what you need. Here's the thing. we've turned over what you need. You're not taking our server. But the, and I'm not suggesting that, that she's guilty because we don't know. But if you've got a suspect of some foul play and they're a suspect of foul play and you say, give me the evidence, and they say, I've given you all the evidence you need. Don't worry about the rest. It just wouldn't fly. It makes no sense whatsoever.
But that's why you don't do it. That's why you don't do it.
That's right.
You don't
That's
do
right.
that. And in fairness, if Hillary was Jeb Bush or if Hillary was Mark Rubio, if he did the same thing, I would be criticizing, saying, well, come on now. It's 2015. Everybody knows and know that your emails are subject to subpoena. But everyone knows if you are having a job, they tell you this email address at monalisa.como@statedepartment.gov should be your only email address for state business. And if you start to send any emails from your personal email, understand that your email address could be, and all of the contents of your personal email could be subject to subpoena, which is embarrassing. And so, in fairness, and I was watching this on one of the shows, that, oh, well, the defenders of Hillary was saying, and Hillary's too smart to let this bring her down. Well, I beg to question why didn't go down this route. There was no reason to put yourself and nor your supporters in a camp where you say, even Warren Buffett knows that he's got his personal emails that he can say these belong to me and his attorney can defend it, and then it could be his emails at Berkshire Hathaway that is the property of the shareholders. Hillary has fundamentally put herself and her supporters in a bad place because she couldn't make the right determination early on and say, I'm only going to use the whitehouse.gov emails, and those are the ones that I'm going to use for conducting business, and therefore I can protect it. She should have never entered in the option of her personal email ever, and especially since it's huge hypocrisy when you say, this is what the State Department and the employees have to do, and this is what I have to do. And then word comes out, I think in the last day or so, that now she's hosting emails of other people that were also in the State Department, and I don't know how much truth there is to that, but there are other people who worked for her at the State Department that hosted their emails that she was conducting on that server. So I, to your point, do I think that she did anything wrong? No, but why do this, right? Just why open yourself up to that scrutiny?
You mentioned Jeb, and in full disclosure of holding both sides of the party accountable, he's got the same situation going on where when he was the governor, he did the same thing. He used Jeb.org, something to that effect. I believe there's some question whether he turned over all of his emails. And frankly, I don't want a president of this nation who doesn't have the wherewithal and the smarts to say, I'm not going to use my personal device for government business. So Jeb should be held to the same scrutiny. Neither of them, in my humble opinion, have enough street smarts, book smarts, whatever level of smarts, to lead this nation. And by the way, why else would you do it unless you're hiding something? I'm always
they're arguing that it was easier, but still.
But I don't want to hear easy. You're not appointed to the Secretary of State or potential presidential candidate or the governor of Florida to do things the easy way. Doing something easy and wrong is really not the right path to go. I'm not afraid for screening at checkpoints because I've got nothing to hide. I'm not afraid to be asked about my residency in this nation because I've got nothing to hide. I'm not afraid for someone to come into my house and check things out because I have nothing to hide. Now, certainly personal property rights is a different issue, but I'm just saying if you have nothing to hide, then you shouldn't.
And in fairness, I think it takes the American people also, it treats us as naive. I don't know very many adults who don't have more than one email, a personal email and a private email. And in my case, I know I've got four emails, and that's because of the two different companies, the radio station and a personal email. And you have multiple emails as well. Well, our devices help segregate that. And frankly speaking, the people who you interact with know which email to contact. So family only contacts me on this email, and work I only get on this email. And so to say that it was easier, I actually think it's harder because you're convoluting the whole dialogue, and it should be much easier to your point. It begs to question your ability to multitask if you cannot separate clear email. And I know many of her supporters will say that, you know, we're belaboring a point or we're picking on her. No, it applies to anybody. If a simple task of segregating personal emails is too much for you or for your staff, then how the hell can you manage a country and make great decision-making on that front without using that excuse? And so I personally don't think that there's anything on there that is going to be a smoking gun. I think it's just embarrassing material that she might have said about people or her personal beliefs. Do I think there's any collusion in the sense of, you know, keeping the email server away? I question it because I don't know how many people would go to that extent to create a personal server.
You don't know about
That's
Benghazi,
actually a lot
right? And we'll never know about Benghazi unless the server gets partitioned over. But so I'll give you last word, but my last commentary on this, because I don't want to belabor it, but I do think both Jeb and Hillary should have the same scrutiny. And here's my view. We both get hundreds and hundreds of emails a day, and I work for a very large institution, and I get very important emails that need my attention. What I don't want is ESPN.com. I don't want my buddies that I'm in a fantasy football league. I don't want my son who wants to talk about football. I don't want our other son who wants to talk about games. I don't want all of the other emails that have nothing to do with my employment and the very critical decisions I have to make getting in the way in an inbox that I have to focus, right? First in, first out. Most important message needs to be read. Why would I want yoga and Chelsea's emails from her wedding getting in the way of state matters? I'm a mid-level executive in corporate America, and I don't want collusion and extra noise so I can make the best decisions for my institution. I sure as heck wouldn't want my Secretary of State saying, for ease of use, I'm going to take "we have a problem at Benghazi" email, and it might come behind 16 yoga emails and get in the way. It makes no sense, and I'm very frustrated with the logic of, one, having the crass nature to say, I know that we expect, you know, a governor of Florida, a secretary of state, former senator of New York, and potential presidential candidate, both of them being potential presidential candidates, saying, we expect you to live by the rules of law and society of America, but we're not going to apply standards that we expect you all to live
right by.
We're going to go rogue. It's just the whole discussion is really challenging, and I think it nullifies both of them from having serious candidacy because they don't think rules apply to them. And it makes no sense, by the way. It makes no sense that an email from someone saying we got a problem in Benghazi is going to get behind 16 emails about yoga and Chelsea's wedding party. Your last word.
I don't think that this is something that's going to go away quietly. I do think part of the problem is now you have was it Newsweek or Time that we saw the headline, the cover of their story? You've got, but New York Post actually had an article on it, I think 2 days ago, in regards to the fact that this might have been leaked by the White House in retribution for the midterms not turning out so well and the Obamas not getting as much support from the Clinton supporters. And so I think, in fairness, it'd be great to have somebody, again, fresh, right? A little bit, there's nothing wrong with having experience. I'm all for the experience. But I do think having any credentials in D.C. right now is actually a disadvantage for the next presidential election, whether that's male or female. I'm a huge proponent of seeing a female president out there, and I would like us to have more candidates than just one, and the one that has technically been anointed by everyone. What it does is then it blocks any potential strong contenders out there. And I do think there's a lot of strong Democratic female. I know, you know, we'll talk about the next one on the Republican, but I think on the Democratic side, there's a lot of strong female representatives as well as governors, right? And even past and present that could actually step up to the plate and be really good contenders. But no one's giving them a chance. And I think part of that is the party itself, but I also think that the media, thinking that there could only be one candidate, actually does us all a disservice for women trying to enter into politics. It's back to that old notion that if there's 10 seats at the table and two women have it, that women come in and generally fight for the two that are already appointed to them, as opposed to trying to go for all 10 seats. And so we need to have more women, both on the Democratic side and on the Republican. I think we've got, on the Republican side, we have women that are trying to get in. On the Democratic side, I think they do the party a disservice thinking that there's only one strong candidate and not giving any consideration for some of the great politics and somebody who doesn't have a lot of the baggage of the Clintons. I think the Clintons have done great for the party. I just think that this next generation of voters, and I think it's time for somebody different with a different name. So let's go into someone else, Carly Fiorina. And we've talked about her in the past, but she's been getting a lot of press, negative in the media, specifically for the pro-liberal ones, because they think that Carly's only job in life is to rip apart Hillary Clinton, not that she might have any good ideas of herself, and I'm a Carly supporter. But she's a part of a new initiative called the Unlocking Potential Project, and it's been out there for a year or so. Her conference is kicking off in Virginia here in the next few weeks. And I'm really engaged by this, and I'll read you the mission from the Unlocking Potential Project. The mission: today, America suffers from self-inflicted wounds. Our nation has everything we need to lead, grow, and prosper. We must unlock the full potential of every American and unleash the power of this great nation. This requires worthy goals, common purpose and leadership, connecting conservative principles to people's lives and struggles in a 21st century, and emerging differently in the political process. The mission of the Unlocking Potential Project is to engage women with new messages and new messengers by focusing on personal interactions with voters and going beyond the traditional method of persuading and turning out voters. Women are a vastly underutilized resource and represent half our nation. We cannot permit liberal orthodoxy to marginalize women or suppress their enthusiasm on our candidates. And that's particularly why I'm very much in support of Carly's initiative here. I'm a firm believer, especially being a minority woman, my gender should not determine my political party. I think that that is sexist to begin with, to say that I can only be a Democrat because I'm a minority and that anything else means I'm brainwashed, or I can only be a liberal woman because as a woman I can only support the Democratic Party. We are half of the nation and we're half of the population. It is sexist to think that only men get the opportunity to vote on both sides, Democratic and Republican, and women are only relegated to one party. The freshness of the Unlocking Potential Project to me is twofold. Number one, it's looking at the voter base differently, right? Especially for the party that Carly represents and that I will most likely vote for. It's giving women an opportunity to, number one, be proud of the fact that they may not believe in Hillary politics, but number two, that we have a woman to get behind. And Carly has a great story. She's brought herself up from nothing. She also has worked her way up to the top. She is a trailblazer. She was called many nasty things as she was one of the first female technology CEOs ever, and still continued to pick herself up and challenge herself in the California politics and trying to run for senator, and then also now trying to be a part of the presidential race. So I'm for the Unlocking Potential Project. I'm not even going to hide that, but I think it's a great opportunity. We're still going to bring you updates on what everyone else is doing, but I love the fact that there's another alternative for women voters and for women not to be ashamed that if you're not voting for Hillary, that you must suppress your vote or not be public about the fact that you disagree with it. We should be for, if anything, we as women should be promoting more women candidates, not just saying you either vote for Hillary or you're not supporting of women. And that's why I believe in the No Mean Girls campaign. We can't just say we only get behind one woman. We have to promote every woman who wants a chance at this. So that was my rant. Jay, what's your thought?
I love your rant. Rant away. But I'm with you on Carly as well. And I don't know if she would even be a serious contender. The president of the United States, I mean, she's had some struggles with the Senate race in California and getting elected, but, you know, it's tough to get elected as a Republican in California, but I would say that I love her influence. But she needs to try. I mean, more people need to do what she's doing. I have no shame in saying that I'm right of center. I'm, in fact, conservative on fiscal matters. Those of us need to get the message out that it's okay to be fiscally conservative. Austerity needs to happen. We can't blow money. And so the fact that she's doing this is fantastic. Now, she's take heat when she got promoted at HP. So this is an interesting dichotomy. She gets promoted and said, I hope that we're at the point that everyone has figured out that there's not a glass ceiling. She got promoted to a Fortune 100 CEO position and got
chastised.
Meanwhile, the reverse to that is you've got the president of our nation, Barack Obama, who continues to think that there still is a glass ceiling for minorities, right, in spite of him ascending to the top office, and almost perpetuates that it has gotten no better. And you look at the contrast and the forward-thinking, positive leadership, like Nelson Mandela when he was incarcerated for 27 years, and then he got elected president, and all of his inner circle was saying, why are you being so nice to the apartheid group? And he said, we have to forgive, we have to move on, and we can't hold old bias, heal as a nation. And so you've got Carly getting promoted all those years ago, saying, we're going to move on, women. We're going to heal. We're going to heal as a gender, and we're going to embrace the fact that I broke the ceiling. And then you've got others, politics, that won't even dare embrace it because, frankly, it reduces how important they think they are. I applaud her for, one, her message all those years ago, really helping heal. I think she gets it on a lot of different levels, and I'm excited to change the message for fiscal conservatives because we're not all bad. Call a conservative because there are conservatives out there that are socially conservative but spent like a drunken sailor, and I won't name names, but I wouldn't call them conservative. Fiscal prudence is not a bad thing, and I'd like to see her get the message out.
I would say you're more libertarian, but we could argue that some other time. And I do agree with you that there's been bad job for messaging, right? So anybody who's right of center has always had bad flack. I believe a ton of people who are right of center just call myself an independent just to play it safe rather than calling themselves. I think, if anything, going back to what Carly brings to the table, I agree with you. It's going to be a long stretch for her in terms of challenging the presidential nomination when you've got some pretty strong contenders across the board. But what she's doing is vital to the party, and not just for the Republicans. What she's doing is vital to the Democrats as well. We cannot anoint anyone. And I've seen this far too often in my career where there's been a woman who's been elevated to a position and she doesn't do much to help other women in the career because she fought so hard to get there. She's holding on to that seat for dear life, but she doesn't do anything to elevate other women up. I would have preferred to see Hillary during her time and tenure promoting other women candidates as well. And then also getting it out there, but challenging that women could also only think like her and be like her. There's definitely opportunities for all parties for women to play a part. But I don't like the messaging that if you are a woman, our anointed candidate is Hillary and can only be Hillary because that's the way it is. And if you therefore don't vote for her in the primary and don't support her, you're going against your gender. That's not fair to women in general because you're saying that we're single thread, single concept, single belief, single value system, and that's sexist in itself. So I welcome what Carly's bringing to the table. I welcome more Democratic women to come back and actually try for the seat. You've heard me say this. I think Janet Napolitano is a great contender, but she's obviously moved on to other things, into education. I am going to say this. Former Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius, I wish she never took the HSH secretary. I think she would have been a great, given her policies and what she did for the state of Kansas, could have been a great contender for that, but she's got too much baggage. I think the party itself should look at the women governors. I don't think they have anybody that's been tenured, but also the women congresswomen, to see what kind of ideas, fresh ideas out there. And then, and more importantly, especially Deborah Wasserman Schultz, get behind them. Especially being a woman heading up the party, she should be supporting more women contenders and not saying that it's only Hillary or no women at all. So that's my thoughts on it. I think kind of killed it.
I think we should keep killing it.
Be back next week with more content for you so we can share about women trailblazing and those making the headlines. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll talk to you next time.